All right. So I guess we can continue. The idea now is to have a breakout session and to do some discussion just in groups, just to kind of make it a bit more lively and a bit more involved. I think sometimes involvement is really important in these matters, because when you are involved, that's usually when you learn about these things. If you're too passive, I think sometimes you just fall asleep, especially after lunch. It's really, really bad time. So what I was supposed to do, Lehar? Are you clear? Are you clear about this, or how do you want to organize this? How many groups do we have? Four. Okay. How many people are here? So 20 people. Okay. And then you kind of sit in a circle or something. Is that the idea? Okay. Yeah. Okay. So just people, and then halfway, and a quarter, and then they sit in a circle like that, and then we have a discussion. Okay. So before we do that, we should have an idea what we want to discuss, right? It's kind of an important point, so we don't kind of become too random. So what we were thinking of was to discuss why bother learning about dependent origination here. Yeah, so if you're starting wondering that, why you came, this might be a good opportunity to clarify why you came here and what this is all about. So why bother learning about dependent origination? Is that a reasonable topic? Or does someone think that's anyone have a better suggestion? No one has a better suggestion? Huh? Anyone has a worse suggestion? Huh? Okay, well, let's go with that one then. Okay, why bother learning
about politics? Let's discuss politics.
Politics.
That's the worst.
Okay, who should win some election somewhere? Anyway, so let's do that then. And so please form yourself into four circles: 1, 2, 3, 4, and then we can have the discussion. One of the monks will be part of each group, except for the fourth group. Who's going to lead the fourth group? Lehar, you're going to be the leader of the fourth group. Lehar will look after the fourth group. Okay, marvelous. Okay, let's go. We have about an hour or so.
Politics, you scallywag.
Huh? Politics, you scallywag. That's a good point.
Maybe
ask Jake what he had in mind for the white people. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Yeah, maybe people online, they can use the chat room to discuss the same topic. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, they're pretty organized over there.
Oh, yes.
That's three groups. I can make those better. I have one more.
Oh, that's a four group there. Yeah.
Okay.
That's good.
Yeah, 1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Well, this is an enormous group over there.
Sorry, that's so loud. We think there might be some people who have come for the Saturday meditation group. So if you have, this is not the meditation group, this is the workshop, but you're more than welcome to join the discussion. So this is not the meditation group. So we put a notice out that the meditation group is cancelled for the next 6 weeks, including this week, because we're running a workshop for the whole day. Yeah, but you're welcome to stay and join the discussion, and yeah. Thank you. And I think the intent with the breakout is that, there'll be like just open discussions based on the topic that Ajahn Brahmali has mentioned. And then at the end of it, it'll be good if one of the team can share what the group has come up with. I'll pass around some papers, whoever is the scribe can actually take some notes.
Such a big teaching, and someone coming to it new.
That's the thing. You have to start,
somewhere, yeah. And the teacher looking out to the front of the room saying, how many have never heard it before, and how many have been studying it a long time? And they're always looking for methods to try and get the idea over that most people would understand it, and they feel it's beneficial to their life. That it can be used. So we'd all have different experiences, you know, around the room.
I just share a little bit. My English is not so good, and when the Vantage teaching, I have to use my own Google translation to Chinese. I'm here to sign up this course is because I want to understand more about what is in the room. Is it in independent synchronicity? Okay, so when I attend the morning lesson, I understand that actually ignorance is means that you have to understand people that don't understand the truth of the understanding of the truth. So they go into the ignorance. So with the ignorance, we come with action to do the wrong thing. Then I also come to understand that I'm here that I benefit from this, and I understand that in the learning means you have the right understanding, you know, in life, and the right understanding of Dharma, therefore you will get your own. Why don't you share a little bit? Anyone?
Your English is very good, by the way.
Because many words I keep taking for them.
You've got the idea across.
I think it's so fundamental. So fundamental to being a Buddhist, besides what happens as a Christian, where God created you. So this is really fundamental, and once you get a grip on it, you also realize it's not simple. It's not simple. And I'm sure I haven't even been able to delve below the surface, so I know there's a lot to learn. Which most of us go into, and we
neglect the picture. Many people have the same perception as people have spoken so far. It's about trying to get more depth. And
my understanding is the dependent origination covers all aspects of Buddhism in one discourse or one section, like it covers the Four Noble Truths and non-self, things like all our relations between the aspects. So it looks like everything is there, but it includes the...
Is it on there?
Is it around? Yeah.
Going from here.
It's going. It's look.
Oh, sorry. No.
Yeah.
It's being streamed.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So that's what I thought. It's important to learn independent origination.
I'm glad I spoke up with you.
Understand it rightly, and in our contemplation, as we meditate and have experiences, we have a reference. Otherwise, our thoughts will take us away from the past. So it's important to have this course, this workshop, to help us be mindful and be aware of what's going on in our mind. Thank you.
What would you have what would you like to say in 6 weeks' time at the end of the course? What would you have liked to have learned across the 6 weeks?
Well, I would like to say that we all be sort of fans, but...
I like that.
Nice answer.
I'm the same. I just want to broaden my knowledge on dependent origination. Thanks.
So do you have much experience, much knowledge before you came?
Yeah, I have a basic understanding. It's a 12-week symbol.
Yeah.
I agree with what that gentleman says, in that dependent origination covers such a wide variety of things, central to the Buddhist teaching. But for myself personally, I also want to answer the question, if I don't know any of these teachings, but I practice my meditation, would it make any difference? So that's what I'm trying to answer myself. So it's just a very personal thing.
We had mentioned, but for me toward the end of the 6 weeks, what I was hoping and what I've been hoping is now today we talk about all the most of the causes like craving and rebirth and suffering. So I was hoping toward the end I have more methods and way to actually cut down all those craving, so that I won't have a lot of rebirth and suffering in the future. So.
I asked to come. I wasn't going to be a teacher, but each time I hear it, I hear something more. And I remember a conversation with the Dalai Lama probably about 15 years ago. He said in a meeting I was at that sometimes you have to hear things 7 times to hear it the first time. And I said, well, only 7 times? Sometimes it just doesn't, go in. So I didn't know what the gentlemen were putting together, the Venerables were putting together on the slides, but I saw new material there. And, when the Buddha said, how many leaves do I have in my hand and how many leaves in the forest? And I only really want you to understand the leaves in my hand. So as far as I'm concerned, dependent origination describes all of the processes in life. And if you keep going back to that and studying it, then it helps with everything. It helps with meditation. It helps with the reduction of suffering.
I'm at the present moment trying to investigate the 3 universal characteristics of existence. And it is, to my mind, it is easy to understand impermanence. And I can validate that impermanent principle from my own personal experience. Then I move on to the next characteristic, which is dukkha. And dukkha is also understandable in the sense that we experience and we see sufferings everywhere. But when I come to anatta, it is a little bit harder to understand the principle of anatta and how anatta is related to sufferings. Now, my understanding is to suffer, you need someone, a self, to suffer. Otherwise, suffering exists everywhere. But if there's no one to suffer, suffering doesn't exist. So, by coming to the understanding of paticca samuppada, maybe I can then understand what suffering is in the true sense. See, because the aspect of paticca samuppada is non-self. So if I can understand that, then I will be able then be easier for me to understand or to free yourself from suffering.
Me again. I hope that by the end of the 6 week, I would be able to handle myself better and understand the more details about maybe say one of the DO, say craving. So if I can practice more on that, I believe that I will be benefit for the rest of my life when I'm here. So I hope that by the end of 6 week, I'll be able to understand more and practice in my life, to make not just understand words. I want to practice in my life, daily life, okay, to make it better.
Well, I've been brought up in a family whereby we've been taught the Buddhist teachings, and I started my journey a few years ago officially. So I've been learning things here and there, like craving, rebirth, but never together. And this was really fascinating for me that it's in 12 steps and it all relates, interrelates together. I'm very, very keen to learn. And I think that when we learn the bigger picture, we're able to put down petty things and not hold on to it anymore. And that's what I want to do by the end of 6 weeks, learn something new and be a bit better.
Maybe you shouldn't stream this one. I'm, I'm one of the people who came for the 3 o'clock meditation. I was sitting here meditating and opened my eyes and you'd all formed a group round about me. So, yeah, I don't know. So I guess I don't have any expectations. Sorry. Thank you. But thank you. Thank you for sharing.
Yes, I'm here to learn about dependent origination, not knowing a lot about it, and also to be able to maybe reduce my delusion and hopefully become a better person.
I'm not used to this. no real expectation, but hoping that I would pick up or drop my, what I call, attachment, right, from what I'm currently doing, and then concentrate on practicing. Very weak, but that's me. I'm not comfortable.
I know a little bit about the Four Noble Truths, and I use that as a guiding principle. And I guess became Buddhist only 20 years ago. I was Catholic before. So although I was born in Sri Lanka, which is a Buddhist country, I get my knowledge from coming here and also reading books. So Ajahn Sumedho, who wrote this lovely book about the Four Noble Truths, is very simply written, and it's only about 30 pages long. I use that, and I think it's a journey of discovering where you are in relation to the Buddha's teachings and wanting to improve every time. Sometimes, because of life, busy life, you don't have a chance to maybe go to a long retreat like myself. So having the 6 weeks of single Saturdays actually allows me to come and meditate and learn the dogma as well. So dependent origination for me fits really well within the Four Noble Truths, especially the second one, and that's why I asked the question earlier about how the craving fits into the causation of suffering, and also then the cessation of suffering. So you then do the opposite of what the cause is, so that would be the mugga, which is the way, is to understand what causes it and stop doing what causes it. But like everybody else in life, although you might know what the conceptual one is and you might meditate and see certain aspects, when you're actually living life, it's really hard to see sensations, feelings, and then try to control yourself in a way where you're progressing. So I guess in a way we are all on a journey, and I'm trying to get better at everything, whether it's on the cushion in meditation or in life.
I came here because I heard that dependent origination, it covers all aspects of Buddhism, like he mentioned, most of us mentioned about it, and to go into a depth to get the teachings with the monks who had gone deep into it and see how it affects me and if possible to practice these things. Right.
Yes. Something that I would like to really learn more about is what bhava really means. It's nice to see different translations given to it. It's usually translated as becoming, and you just wonder what exactly becoming is before the birth. So for me, that would be interesting to understand just how that process works and what exactly that bhava, exactly what it means. And then with bhava tanha and things like that. So that would be fascinating to, if I can have a deep understanding of that by the end of the course, that will be really good.
Start over again.
want to ask, have thought this afternoon, but from what you've seen today, the path that they described so far, you would like to have an explanation on
I think the gentleman who asked that question on the place for the birth in that sequence, why it's in the middle, I think that's opened up my mind to try to rethink about the sequence. So the way I understood, it's not the real sequence of the birth like that. I think birth is in the somewhere in the lowest level, but before that, what causes the birth and the rest of the thing after the birth, what are the results? Is that what you understand? Maybe Venerable can add why the birth is in the middle. Yeah.
Did everybody hear the question? So it was going back earlier today when a gentleman at the back of the room said, explain to me why birth is at the end of the process and also at the beginning, and was confused about that. So the 12 factors of dependent origination start with avijja, which is ignorance, yeah? The antidote to ignorance is wisdom, which is vijja. So what the teachings are pointing towards is that wisdom comes from living a certain life, developing meditation so you can see things as they really are, and then having the wisdom from those experiences that you will stop the process, okay? What is the process we're talking about? Well, it's the process of rebirth. So what I've found in my limited time in monastic life is there's not a lot of teachings that directly go to the night of enlightenment where it's said that the Buddha had tivijja. So, 3 points of wisdom. Does everybody know what the tivijja are? So, there were 3 watches in the night. In the first watch of the night, because of the depth of the meditation, he was able to see many, many past lives. So, he could recollect at a very fundamental level who he had been, whether he was a he or she, in many, many past lives. What clan I was in, what location I lived in, what tasks I undertook. So that was the first piece. The second aspect of the night of enlightenment is to say, why would that be the case? If it happens to me, does it happen to other people? So in the second watch of the night, he had a real appreciation, almost like a divine eye, to see many beings going into future and past lives. And why? Well, it seemed to be related to their karma. So if somebody had done bad deeds, they could move from the human level down to an animal in the next life. If they had done a lot of good things in this life, then they might move up to the deva realm. And if you come to Bodhinyana, in the room where we get our food, where it's all laid out at lunchtime, there's a lovely diagram on one wall which talks about the 31 levels of existence. And we're on kind of level 4 as the human level. But the more divine levels above that, number 26, 27. Okay? To the Buddha, that wasn't sufficient. The third aspect is, how do people move from one lifetime to the other? And the Eightfold Noble Path comes from the fact of this is the antidote if you don't wish to be reborn, if you don't want to keep coming back into samsara. So do you remember the wheel up there with the god of death, Yama? So if you keep craving for the same things, then that's going to bring you back. Yeah? So, if I chose to commit suicide, I'm going to be reborn because that's a craving for annihilation. If I have a craving for another deep relationship with someone of the opposite sex, that's likely to bring me back in another rebirth. I may have stacks of karma that hasn't spent out yet from my life as a CEO in financial services and charity. I have to own that karma, and I can't rush the process, so I have to do the best I can with the time I've got left to walk the path, but not grasp of, you know, I've got to be a Sotapanna by Wednesday, and I've got to be an Arahant, you know, 3 years from now, that type of thing. So what dependent origination is trying to do is kind of break it down into a simple set that you can look at each one and say, why does this happen? And if that is that the truth that the Buddha described, which bit do I need to understand for me? And do I need to spend a little bit of time there to understand it? I'll share a quick story that influenced me. Ajahn Chah, who was Ajahn Brahm's teacher, obviously, he said that consciousness works so fast that it's almost like falling out of a tree and hitting the ground. And you wanted to understand what happened between you fell off the branch and you hit the floor. But it happened so quickly, you got no recollection of the steps. So consciousness is milliseconds all of the time. You know, it's like you're watching the television and this ad comes up and you go, I must have a Coke or I must have an ice cream. It hooks you very, very quickly. It may only be a color. It may only be a recollection of a taste. Yeah? So dependent origination is trying to sort of give you the basic, well, not the basic framework because it's fairly profound, and then say you could go into each part you want and try and understand the links, or you want to delve into that. But in a sense, that's all you need to know about the process of life, either moment to moment or throughout life, or from life to life.
Following your reasoning, can I say that whatever happens around us happens in degree? You've got a micro, you've got the...
Close because they're listening. Yeah, thanks.
We've got the micro level, you've got the minor level, and you've got the macro level. And depending on at which level we are in to see things, but they are all the same. Whether it's micro, macro, or level, or minor level, the process is the same. It's just like trying to understand Patitya Samuppada from the very basic cause and consequence, cause and effect. From that level of understanding cause and effect, which every one of us can see as Ajahn Chah says, I think everything happens around us is trying to teach us. But do we have the wisdom to pick up the teaching, to understand, to appreciate the teaching? So, no, in this case, then, you know, it's a sort of like a depth of understanding. The deeper you understand, the more you understand, and you try to validate that understanding against your personal experience in life, then you can then confirm that, yes, this particular concept is now changing my view of the world, my understanding of the world.
Very good.
Me again?
I don't know.
Somebody could respond to that.
What question would you like answered? I'm sorry, I don't know your name.
Tatsu.
Yeah. So, Tatsu said something I think was very important is whilst we're all here together as Buddhists, we're also very different. We've also had different experiences. We're also at different levels. And when I was teaching out in the outside world in lay life, I used to sort of run a joke about why men and women couldn't communicate with each other. And I used to borrow two mobile phones, two iPhones, and I would hold them up and say, you know, when one party communicates with the other, they run some software in the phone and they communicate that to the other person. And the other phone receives it and goes, I don't know what's going on here. I don't know where that's coming from. So they scramble their software and they send something back. By the time, you know, we get to 6-7 years of age, we may be composed of millions of bits and conditioning that have come from our parents, that have come from our schools, that have come from our teachings. The thing I like, this is more of my response to what you were saying, is Venerable Kandana, from one teaching, got the basis of the message, which is, everything is coming into being and also ceasing. So you can make this very complex, I think. You can go very, very deep. You think you're going very, very deep, but it hasn't sunk in. You know, it's like I could go and do a PhD and I want to go out and teach then, or I want to be a master scientist or a master physician. But I can't explain it to another person. I can't teach very well. I did the studies, but it didn't land with me. I didn't understand it. And I'll just tell you a few more stories from lay life. When I came to Australia in 1994, I was headhunted to run the marketing for Commonwealth Bank across Australia. And I inherited an advertising budget of $60 million a year, which was one of the biggest advertising budgets in Australia. And all of the television companies wanted to meet me and say, come and spend our money with us, you know. And they said, oh, you should come and meet the script writers for this show, Home and Away. Come and see them. And they said, what products will you be selling? And I said, well, I think we have to do mortgages and term deposits. And they said, oh, good. We'll write the story around the time that your advert will appear in the episode, and we'll cause a big emotion to happen just before your ad shows. The job that we have as a TV company is to write 27 different emotions into a 23-minute segment so that we can influence people to do what you want. It's conditioning. It wasn't about Home and Away, were these characters real or not. It was about stimulating traffic for the people who were paying for the program. And that, in a small sense, is all of the conditioning that we allow in on a daily basis. We don't put filters in place, you know. Is Trump telling the truth or not? How should I vote next week, yeah? Do I need to go and buy this new car? And when we sort of make the decision, we think we're doing it from free will, but we could have been conditioned 5 or 10 years back, 10 minutes ago, just by somebody who sort of talked in this circle. The point of meditation is to slow you down. Slow you down so you can see this mental and physical flux going on all of the time and then come to your own appreciation. Did that help answer?
I have this experience like when Donald Trump got infected with the COVID-19, and my feeling arises in me, and then I say, I'm supposed to feel happy because I don't like him, all right? But then I suddenly am aware of that feeling, and then I stop. Then what do I do with it? What am I supposed to do next? It doesn't bother me. It doesn't, because it's in America, it's not in Australia. It's just that I see that arising and I sort of like stop it. But then But I know that I'm aware of my feeling arises. But then, what then?
I think sometimes what you think is unwholesome can give you what looks like joy at the beginning, but the karma will come later, the fruits of karma. Because if you don't have wholesome intention and you laugh, at that moment you might enjoy it, but then later it might come. So you don't see the negative aspect straight away. So we don't know. That's why you had to be mindful. We don't know to correct ourselves. But obviously you did. You stopped thinking that. Yeah.
But does it mean that I let it continue and being aware of it, or do I stop it? I'm just asking. What should I do?
Anybody?
Actually, I was going to say for me there's quite a conflict between being aware of things like my professional knowledge that I've got and the experience making me more of a person, really. All the things you get that actually seem to be good things, like a helping profession that I was in, that's a good thing. But you realize that it's actually just making you feel more of a self, and you're not a self. And then there are things like who to vote for on election day, and how to influence your children or your grandchildren to behave well and to have good morals and to engage with life. And to me, there's a bit of a conflict between knowing that I'm not really a self and everything I've got will disintegrate and nothing I have will last, and actually making an effort to have a good life as well. That's really weird, actually.
I'd like to give an indirect answer, because I think one of the benefits of the course is if things come up for you, you take the 6 weeks to look at it yourself and then say, okay, is this going to give me more suffering or is it going to give me less? Yeah. So here's my indirect answer. We're in a difficult fight with the ATO at the moment. We're suing them in the federal court. This is the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. This building has a fund related to it, and they took away our tax status about a year ago. We've been fighting for 2 years and saying they don't consider this is a place of teaching, that it's not open enough times and there's not enough of a curriculum for it to be considered a school of teaching, and therefore that if someone wants to give money to the fund, they could get a tax receipt that they could then use at tax time, okay? So, on the face of it, it's a very difficult aspect with the tax office. Since I started working on it 3 years ago, I try and offer them metta 3 or 4 times a week, because I try and put myself in their shoes. Is the people fighting us may not want to do this, saying, I can go online and I can see these great teachings and they're doing really good things in the world, but they're following somebody else's conditioning and say, they don't meet our definition of a school, so we make it really difficult. Coming back to your example, it's a big teaching for me to try and express metta all of the time and make sure that I'm approaching them as human beings. They are suffering too. They may be suffering more than I am because they have quotas to reach. They're very desperate that they win. We'll do the best we can. If we happen to lose, we know morally we've done the right thing. Yeah? So, when you break down the dependent origination, any problem in life, you can run through the dependent origination model. Yeah? And say, am I ignorant? I could be ignorant of the fact that they're human too, yeah, that they think they're doing the right thing. So we're immediately in conflict, yeah, before consciousness comes up. So when it is into consciousness, when it creates feelings, when it leads to a craving, I must win, BSWA, you know, I need to march off into the sunset as a hero. No, 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 no. That's just going to stop me sleeping at night in the monastery and the like, yeah? So you can take a specific example over the 6 weeks and say, okay, I'll bring this into the workshop and I'll ask for conversations with Ajahn Brahmali or Sunyu if I get stuck, or I'm here right now. How can I use this as an antidote? And dependent origination, whether you believe in a future life anyway, is a useful tool to reduce your suffering here and now. So we go around one last time. If somebody has a big question they want to ask, or they want our group to bring up, saying, please be more specific on craving, or...
I want to know how dependent origination fits into the whole of the Abhidhamma writings.
No, that's okay. I'd love you to ask that one of Ajahn Brahmali. He may cover it in the last session. So they're going to go through the 12 factors in a bit more detail, setting up for... Microscopically, they'll go through each of the 12 over the next sort of 5 weeks. We're a bit traditional in the sense of we want to go back to the original word of the Buddha. We don't put as much emphasis on the Abhidharma, because that came 4 or 5 centuries later. And we say, I mean, if Ajahn Brahm was here, he'd get a bit cheeky and humorous and say, I don't follow that too much because I don't follow that too much because I don't see it as actually what the Buddha taught. If somebody comes along later and says, oh, I think the Buddha had the wrong words there, we'll change that a little bit. And then it sort of passes on like that. So What they try very hard to do is give you the knowledge from the suttas and nothing else. You won't find the Abhidharma comes up much.
Sorry to interrupt. I know I'm not the boss here, but just want to remind people. Ajahn, did you say we do this until 4 o'clock? Yeah. So I suggest maybe just take another minute or so just to summarize, and then what we'll like to hear back from each of the teams, what has been discussed. I noticed this group has not been doing any writing. Just because Ajahn Brahmali is here doesn't mean you guys can get away with it. Reminder. He might be sitting in front but I'm holding the mic now. Oh, very good.
I'm not sure this is working.
Okay, so that Venerable Sunil's group said they've done a lot of writing, they might be able to cover for your group. So I'll give everyone maybe another 1-2 minutes just to round up your discussion, and then we'll go to each group to just talk about what was being discussed. Thank you.
I'm not a good one to explain.
I didn't want to ring out over the whole room. That's all. Would knowledge of teaching improve meditation? Of the teachings improve meditation? Repetition leads to understanding. That's where you said hearing something 7 times. Before you actually understand it. To improve the practice of daily life, to develop understanding of what becoming is. I think that's what somebody said. It changes your worldview. Dependent origination leads to wisdom in all areas of life. Creates a sense of proportion.
And then the question about the Abhidharma, that the Abhidharma isn't part of the Buddha's teachings. I know there was an awful lot more, but I couldn't hear a lot of it. Yeah.
Sorry, I can't hear too well. Yeah. Askajan Brahmali, which he would think was best because it appears in so many places. So yeah. I don't have the historical context of which one came first, but I think Well, I think it's in the very early suttas, and my understanding is the first teaching is of the full 12. But when others, and even Sariputta teaches, then says, here's 5 or here's 7, depending on what the nature of the discussion was.
Okay. So, maybe the group stay where it is so that we know who's in the group for now. Ajahn Brahmali can go back to his seat. Venerable Sunil can go back to his seat. But the rest, maybe just turn around and face the Buddha statue. Okay. I don't know where he's there. So we're going to go to each group just to do a quick debrief. Don't need to teach us about dependent origination because we have Ajahn Brahmali here. So, but we just want to know, like, why you're here, what is it you want to learn, and whether there was any other interesting topics that were being discussed. So for this group here, who is the representative? Okay. Right, you've got the mic.
So we were looking at why study dependent origination. So actually, there were quite a lot of pearls of wisdom that I didn't capture, so apologies. But these are some of the main points. Would knowledge of the teachings improve meditation? That's one person raised. Repetition leads to understanding. Our Venerable mentioned that it's been said that you need to hear something 7 times before you hear it for the first time. That was interesting to me. To improve the practice of daily life, this is why study dependent origination. To develop understanding of what becoming is. To change your worldview. That dependent origination leads to wisdom in all areas of life. It creates a sense of proportion. And somebody asked, how does it fit into the Abhidharma? And we were told that the Abhidharma, that our teachings are based more on the suttas than the actual teachings of the Buddha, and the Abhidharma wasn't part of that. That's it.
I heard about hear it 7 times, then we'll learn. Ajahn Brahmali, I just realized that we're doing this for 6 weeks. So maybe we should add another week, make it 7. Maybe then we'll understand dependent origination a little bit more. Do you want to address the last comment around Abhidharma?
You kind of open up the Pandora's box of all kind of possibilities. So for that reason, I think it's better to stick with the Sutta worldview because it is consistent. It is the same view. All of the teachings fit together very nicely. And as soon as you move outside of that, you are kind of moving to a different, using a different terminology, a different way of looking at things. And straight away, it doesn't fit as neatly together. The worldview isn't as coherent. And then you start to get new interpretations into it. So there's nothing kind of necessarily bad about the Abhidhamma. It's just that it very quickly can lead you astray because it doesn't belong to the same group of teachings, the same kind of coherence of teachings. I think that can be problematic. But yeah, anyway.
Okay, thanks, Ajahn. We'll go to the next group, which is my group. So just so that you know, I forgot to introduce Venerable Methaji today, but he has come today to support the group because I said we want to have breakout groups and we usually have like monks and nuns, but unfortunately the nuns cannot be here. So I thought Ajahn Brahmali will have woman power next workshop onwards. So this one, there is no monks or nuns, but I think we managed to come out all right. So would you like to go through what was being discussed in the group?
Our group came up with seven items. Number one, to find out what causes the suffering. Number two, to help day-to-day life better, to live a better life. Number three, to understand the ignorance. Number four, in order to understand the path to liberation. Number five, better understanding on dependent origination. Number six, to understand the connection between 37 factors of enlightenment to dependent origination. Number seven, to find out the connections between the dependent originations to five aggregates. So those were the seven.
Wow, okay, that's pretty comprehensive.
Ajahn, you must understand our group. We can get quite deep because Eddie is here. In case you guys didn't notice. So that's why it's quite profound.
Ooh, okay, we're going to... I think we have to do at least 7, maybe 8 or 9, I think, you know, to cover all of this. Okay.
Okay, so who's representing?
Pauline.
Pauline?
Okay.
Yeah.
Our group, we do it the smart way. We pass everything to Ajahn Brahmali. That's why we don't write anything.
Emptiness. Yay.
Okay, yeah.
But in general, the group do discuss, like, how do we practice, put into practice the dependent origination in our daily life, and how do we do that? Because it's so profound. And we relate it to the Four Noble Truths, especially the Second Noble Truth. And then we talked about also, what else did we talk about? one of our friends here talked about, Ajahn Brahm said that you are not what you are unless you understand original dependence. So that's why we come here to understand more. And we also want to understand the link, the specific link, what it means. Because each has a specific meaning. Because although we just say the attachment, but what is attachment in the original dependence? It's different, I guess so, I guess. What else did we talk about, everybody? We forgot.
Ajahn Brahmali, you want to help your own team?
We talked about the importance how understanding the teachings, the doctrines integrate with the practice. Yeah, how that is important. If you can't just do one without the others. If you want to practice well, you have to understand these teachings properly. That was, I think, an important theme that we talked about. And what you said was kind of interesting. Ajahn Brahm had said, you are dependent origination. So if you want to understand yourself, you have to come here, yeah? Because you are dependent origination. And that is actually one of the essays of Ajahn Brahm where he says that. This is the process of life. So you have to come here to understand what you're doing here. Anything else? Okay.
Okay, so let's go to the last team who... actually thinks that, I think this is the group that thinks that they've got a lot more than the other team, so we'd like to hear what you have.
Okay, look, I'm going to keep this reasonably brief because we do have a lot. but it went from big picture descriptions about why we're here, like understanding the cornerstones of, one of the major cornerstones of the Buddhist teaching, what life is about and samsara is about and where I fit in. Another one down here is the movement from ignorance to wisdom. And understanding cause and effect. And then it went to more specific issues of practicalities like understanding the function of cause and effect in our life and how I take a sense of self from that and how that causes me to be in the world a certain way and either assists or does not assist me to understand and empathise with other people. So the presence or the absence of compassion for other people, depending on my world view of myself in the world. And that was clarified a little bit more with complete teachings found in one place in a sequential manner. A lot of people seem to appreciate that idea that there was a roadmap there. Clarifying the roadmap from Roadmap for Freedom in meditation and also its application in daily lives. So big picture perspectives and then translating it down to what am I doing on the meditation mat and what am I doing driving down the road and, you know, in the supermarket. So it's a broad spread of application for this practice.
Okay.
That's it.
Yay.
Oh, we went one step more. Yeah, I actually put the challenge to people in the group that we've got the list here of what people thought was important. And then I said, okay, so we've all identified for each of us what's important from being here today. And then I said, so what are we going to, what actions are we going to take in some big or small way in the next 7 days to affirm the value of being here today? You know, keep it pretty practical. Okay. Well, each person has to find their own answer for that. Okay.
Yeah, we discussed a few things, but we didn't write them down.
Yeah, so we didn't write it down. What was discussed was we cut down the wanting. That's something that we can easily cut down. And then how do we cut down the wanting? Cutting down looking at the future, being in the present moment. That leads to meditation. More meditation, more present moment, and then that cuts down the wanting and desires. And that's one step to cut down this, you know, the cycle, vicious cycle. Thank you.
Yeah.
What I said, adding on from that, and fully affirming what Prem just said, was, sure, cut down the wanting, but grow the positive, because what we know in just in developmental psychology, in a way, that we foster and blossom in life as individuals from babies to human beings is that we actually have to have the positive examples in our lives because when we grow positivity, craving naturally decreases, aversion naturally decreases. You're going to feel less pissed off with someone who's cut you off in traffic if you've just come out of a deep meditation here at Dhammaloka. So growing the positive and particularly growing the positive, I would say, in our bonds and connections with other human beings, is money in the bank for decreasing craving and decreasing aversion. Yeah.
And that fits into dependent origination because craving is part of dependent origination. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, okay. Okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks, everybody. Some nice ideas.
Yeah. Was that... Everybody thought that was nice? Was it worthwhile? Huh. Everybody liked that? Yeah? Yeah? Okay, so we might as well, I think we will do it. Continue with these things then if everyone agrees. Anyone thought it was a terribly bad idea? No? Everyone is okay? Okay, great. So we'll just, it's good to get some feedback so we know what people enjoy as well. So
Ajahn, sorry to interrupt, but I think there was some feedback saying that this session is perhaps better to be done just after lunch.
That's what I was thinking as well. Like
feeling a little bit like, you know, drowsy after lunch.
Yeah.
But we did remember what Venerable Sunil talked about.
Okay. Yeah. No, I agree. Lynn, yeah? Yeah. Yeah. We have 3 rooms here, so why not use the whole place? You know, maybe we can do that. Yeah? Or outside? Yeah? Because it was a bit difficult, I agree with you. You had to really focus to hear what was going on. Yeah. Okay. I don't know. A lot of the things I heard, I'm being very selective now from what I heard from this, but my sense is that a lot of people are about, you come here to learn dependent origination because you want to put it into practice. You want this to be something that integrates with the rest of your Buddhist life. It shouldn't be just a kind of a theoretical doctrine, but it should be practical, it should be useful. And so I think to me that is a kind of a, I've always felt that way anyway, and I can see that that's actually how many people feel. So we'll try to keep that in mind as we go along here.
Something interesting I found in my group, I haven't listened to any of the others, was actually that, we found this as well. Many people want to learn how to apply these teachings, but there was also some interest in just learning the more, quote, technical details about dependent origination. Many people agree with that as well. They just want to learn more Buddhism, basically, the more technical aspects.
Yeah. I think, exactly. And I think often those two things actually go together, because one of the things that I always found in my Buddhist life is that the more I understood of the Buddhist teachings, the more I could see that whole picture, which every aspect is a piece in the jigsaw, the more confidence I had in these teachings, that they actually were coherent, they were complete, they really gave a path away from suffering towards happiness. And then that confidence in the teachings then gives rise to better practice again. So this idea of making it practical and having confidence in the teaching kind of works together, and it kind of brings out, I think, the best in everyone, in a sense. So, yeah. Okay. Anything else? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's already on there. I think it's going on. Bang. Yeah. 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 Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure. Isn't that the case,
Jake? Because all the live streaming eventually goes into, you can view it on YouTube. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But let's move on, because we have lots more to do. Yeah, 5 o'clock is really optimistic. So we're going to have to fire away at full speed. And those people who think I've talked fast so far, they're going to be really disappointed. We're talking much faster from now on. Now we're really going to speed up. So what we're going to do now is we're going to do a much more thorough outline of dependent origination, where we go through each of the factors in much more detail, so that we lay down the basis for the rest of the course. The next time is going to be a little bit more general teachings, but the rest of the course is going to be all about looking at these teachings in depth. And we need to kind of look at those, laying down the foundation now for understanding what is going on here. So this is going to be the outline. And the way we're going to do this, I'm going to go through all of these factors, and I'm going to look at them as links, how one factor leads to another one. And we're going to start at the end of dependent origination, which is the problem that we are facing. We're facing a problem. It is called suffering. It is called old age and death. And we're going to start from there and then move backwards to understand the causality, how it is that we get to the problem of suffering. And then implied in that is also then the actual solution to the problem is also implied in that. So this is the idea. And this is actually how the Buddha was thinking. It's kind of fascinating. You read the Buddha's biography, and it talks about how he reflected on dependent origination. And the Buddha says, there is old age and death. What is the cause of old age and death? And then he thinks, birth is the cause of old age and death. What is the cause of birth? And then he goes backwards in that way. So we're going to try to follow that process now and see where that leads us. So I'm going to just start talking, Venerable Sunil, so you just join in whenever you want.
I can do the slides if you want.
Okay, but let's just start with the first one. So now we can see we're getting much more deep, because now you have the Pali there as well. So you have rebirth leads to old age and death. Jati pachaya jara marana is the Pali for that. So this is to familiarize you a little bit with the Pali, and jati there is birth or rebirth, jara is old age, marana is death. Marana is related to Mara. You may have heard about Mara, the kind of the deity of death in Buddhism, and it's actually the same word. It's like the Lord of Death is a way of translating the word Mara. And Paccaya is the word which means like conditions or depends on. Yeah, so that's the kind of the important word there. So that is the arrow. The arrow stands for Paccaya. And what is interesting, I'm going to talk about this fairly quickly because we haven't got that much time. But what is interesting here, you will see that the whole sequence of 12 factors, it ends in old age and death. Yeah. It also says suffering, but that's kind of as more like an implication. But the immediate thing the Buddha says is old age and death. And that is interesting in its own right, isn't it? Why doesn't the Buddha just say jati, birth or rebirth, leads to suffering? Why does he say old age and death instead? And to me, there's something very profound about that and important about that. Because what it means is that old age and death in particular... it's like a summary, or it is it's like a bringing together the idea of suffering in one word, in a sense. Death kind of brings in all the factors of suffering, can almost be understood in the idea of death. And this shows you how important the idea of death is in Buddhism, and why the death contemplation is so useful. Why is that? How come suffering is implied by death in this way? And the answer is that the suffering in Buddhism has a lot to do with our attachments and cravings. Yeah, if someone takes away what you crave for, if someone or whatever you are attached to gets destroyed, if a loved one in your life dies, it is very difficult. Yeah, it is really hard. This is a very major part of human suffering, that the things that are close to us get taken away from us. Yeah, so the whole idea of attachment is summarized in death, because when we die, almost everything that we delight in this world, that we are attached to, that we crave for, gets taken away from us. So death is like it brings everything together, all the aspects of suffering, not all, but many, some of the most important aspects of suffering are actually right there in the idea of dying. And the point is that death is something we can relate to. Yeah, we all know about death. Is there anyone here who has never had any friend or family member who has died? Such a person doesn't exist, right? It's like the Buddha asks Patachara, who later on became a very famous nun, and she had, it was Kisagotami, wasn't it? Kisagotami. And she comes to the Buddha, and she's distraught because her child has died. And then the Buddha says, go into the village and get a mustard seed from the house where no one has died. And of course, it's impossible. There is no house where no one has died. And after a while, she realizes, wow, this is a universal truth. Yeah, everyone has family members or loved ones who have died. This is just the nature of existence. So it is something that we can relate to directly. If you talk about suffering in a larger scale, if you talk about samsaric rebirth and you go to this existence, that existence, maybe it is so, maybe it is true, but it's actually not so easy to relate to. It's more theoretical. You may have faith in it, you may not have so much faith in it. I don't have personally any doubt that there is rebirth in other realms of existence, but it's not as immediate as dying. And I think this is why the Buddha makes this the clinch point, the really thing that matters when it comes to suffering, because it is tangible, it is immediate, and we can understand why it is problematic. And so much of the Buddhist teachings, therefore, revolves around death contemplation, because it makes so clear what suffering is about and why this is a problem for human existence. And then it directs us in the right way towards a liberation from this, towards a solution to this particular problem. So this is, I'm just highlighting some of the important factors here, yeah, and why they are explained in the way they are. And we probably will talk more about this later on, because there's a lot to be said about old age and death in particular. But let's maybe leave it at that for now. Would you like to say anything about that, Venerable?
Yeah, we point out old age and death here. It's partly because that's like the standard word jharamaranang that the Buddha used, but almost every time that he explains the sequence of dependent origination, he also continues with the sorrow, grief, pain, etc. It's almost like it's implied by old age and death, I would say, that it's and then at the end of the sequence, he always says, this is how the whole mess of suffering comes to be. So it's not just old age and death. The dependent origination explains all the kinds of suffering that we experience. Yeah. So when it's just one link, we may highlight certain parts of that, but it always implies all the other kind of suffering as well.
Okay, and then of course, then the question arises, if we have suffering, what is the cause of that suffering? The Buddhist answer is birth. Yeah, jati is the cause of suffering, because once you are born into the world, and then all of these things will have to happen to you. You have to get old, you have to die, you have to have sorrow, you have to have all of these things as a consequence. And it is there was this, the old joke about why did the Buddhist coroner get fired? Because he wrote on the death certificate, he wrote cause of death, birth. Yeah, and that that wasn't good enough for the. So if you're Buddhist coroner, you have to be careful, otherwise you might have a problem. So usually in the sequence of dependent origination, usually we say birth is the cause, yeah? But you will notice here that here we actually have written rebirth instead of birth. So why have we put rebirth in here? And the reason is that from a Buddhist point of view, every birth is also a rebirth, yeah? And in a Buddhist context, this would be understood, yeah? In Buddhism, the idea of rebirth is so fundamental to the outlook, the world outlook, that when they hear the idea of birth, well, they would know it actually means rebirth. But from a kind of modern point of view, if you say in the English language, you say birth, actually, there is no implication of rebirth whatsoever. So if we are to hear the same thing that the ancient Buddhists heard when they heard this word, I think it is better to translate it as rebirth, because then we are more, I think, in tune with how the ancient Buddhists would have understood this particular word. It actually, every instance of rebirth or birth is an instant of rebirth. These are not separate. So this is the first point here. Yeah, this is the cause of suffering. Not quite yet, Venerable. Just almost there. The other point is, when we use rebirth, what exactly does it mean? In English, birth is the moment you emerge into the world. Yeah, you come out of your mother's womb and then you emerge into the world, and that is the moment of birth. But that is not what birth means in Buddhism. Yeah, birth has actually a slightly different meaning, and this also matters for our understanding of the sequence. Birth in Buddhism is the moment you re-arise in this world. Your consciousness, your mind comes into this existence. And that happens before you get born. Yeah, it happens while you're still an embryo in your mother's womb. And then at that point is when the consciousness re-arises. That is the meaning of birth in Buddhism. And we can know that. And the reason we can know that is because the way birth is defined in the suttas is defined in terms of the acquisition of the sense faculties, in terms of the appearance of the aggregates, yeah, the factors of existence, how they appear. And that happens before you actually emerge physically into this world. So that is the at the point where you actually are reborn. And that matters, I think, a little bit. We'll see that later on for the interpretation of some of the other factors of this particular, of the overall sequence of dependent origination here. Okay. Is everyone happy with that so far? Yeah? If you're not happy, please let me know. And then we can maybe sort things out as we go along. So the next one here is bhava pachaya jati. Yeah, so jati, rebirth. Pachaya again means like something conditioned or dependence. Yeah, and bhava here, the word bhava quite literally means something like existence. So you could say here that existence conditions jati, or birth depends on existence. Yeah, here he has continued existence We had life before in our translation that we use, which is quite nice. Yeah, life leads to rebirth. How, why does this happen? And here I discussed this with the Basunio before, and we have a slightly different idea of how this works, but the basic outlook is the same. Yeah, it's just that sometimes the technical details might vary a little bit, but the doctrinal outlook is the same. It's just a matter of how we understand this. So because jati is the arising of the mind in a future life, then continued existence is how we are living this life now, and then how that translates into a rebirth in the future. So what exactly does that mean, how you are living now? And the way I understand this is taken from the suttas again, and in certain places the question arises, why is it that someone gets reborn in a jhana realm, for example? And the way that you get reborn in a jhana realm, jhana are these high states of meditation, yeah? The way you do that is by being proficient in meditation, proficient in samadhi, which is deep meditation, in this life. If you are proficient in this life, it means that your mind is leaning towards that. It means that when you sit down, you easily enter samadhi, you easily enter the jhanas, yeah? And then because your mind is leaning in that direction, when you die, your mind is also going to lean in that direction, and then you get reborn accordingly. So there is a very close connection with how you live in this life, what your mind is leaning towards in this life, and then how you are reborn in the future. And the commentaries make this distinction between two types of bhava, the bhava which is the kamma bhava, the bhava which is the actions, how you live now, and the upapatti bhava, which is the re-arising existence, which then is equivalent to rebirth. So how you live now, yeah? So what does it mean? So how do you know where your mind is inclining in this life? And the way that you know where your inclination is, where your bhava is basically by seeing, you know, when you sit down to meditate, where does your mind go? Does it leap towards the peace? Yay, peace. Wow, peace. This is great. Or does it lead to, oh yeah, what am I going to do tomorrow? What are all the problems I have to solve? What are the kind of the dinner I'm going to have? Half an hour left of this course, then I'm going to go back home and have a nice meal or whatever. Where does your mind hang out? And sometimes it will hang out in certain places, other times in other places, but there will be a general place where your mind likes to hang out. And that general place is like the inclination of your mind. And that inclination of your mind, if that is firmly established, that is where your mind will incline when you die, and you will then continue be reborn accordingly. Yeah? Your existence now, where your mind inclines, is then what decides your rebirth in the future. Bhava pachaya jati. Yeah? Am I making any sense? Yeah? Okay. I'm happy. Yes, Chris. Okay, so you're asking whether we can talk about this more in a moment-to-moment thing here. We will talk about that later on, but to me that is not actually dependent origination, that's another teaching. That is to me the evolution of the perceptual process, how perception arises in a human being. It is a sub-aspect of dependent origination, it belongs to it, but dependent origination has to be understood in terms of rebirth. Like I said before, you need the cause of rebirth, and then the result which is suffering for it to be called dependent origination. If you look at it from a perspective of the perceptual process, you're really only looking at the sub-aspect of the whole thing. So I don't want to bring this in now. This is just going to be about dependent origination itself. Do you want to contradict what I'm saying, Rinpoche?
I don't want to contradict it, because I actually, you said that we have some slight different interpretation of the term bhava, which is very innocent difference really between us. We don't fight over these kind of things. there is a slight difference of interpretation, but I don't want to contradict anything you're saying, because I don't disagree with the practical idea that you brought up. You said the way you live your life is going to be very influential or even determine the way you will be reborn. And that is very important, especially for you mentioned also meditation, that your meditation, if you have certain high meditation stage, your mind is inclined towards those things. I agree with all of that. My only slight disagreement is more on a textual basis, I would say, is that how I see the term bhava is, means more not this life, but it means like a more general concept of, as Ajahn Sujato has translated it here, this is Ajahn Sujato's translation that we're using here, so sort of a middle way, you know. We don't use Ajahn Brahmani's or mine. So it's like neutral. So Ajahn Sujato has translated it here, continued existence, which sort of implies in bhava a more general concept of continuation into a next life. Like when you die and you still have the craving and the ignorance and stuff, then there will be continued existence, which is, of course, this continues on from the existence that was in this life. It's like, it is, in a sense, continuation, but I think it's more like, bhava points more to what happens in the next life. Maybe it's, when you mentioned the commentary, they have two parts of bhava. One is this life, kama bhava or something. The other, upapati bhava, the rebirth bhava. The way I read the suttas, I see more of this rebirth bhava in there. But again, that's how I understand the term bhava. But again, this is only a technical issue, and we don't want to make too much out of it. It's just maybe some of you also have this kind of interpretation.
We have to resolve this through a dual boxing match afterwards.
Yeah.
Rock, paper, scissors.
No. Okay, we were sitting in the office at Wadinana Monastery of discussing these matters, and so we kind of see to what extent we agreed or not. So we decided to agree to disagree on this particular thing. But the interesting thing about about Buddhism is that there will always be certain disagreements in terms of subtle things of the Dhamma. In this case, we agree on the overall mechanism. We just disagree on the particular word, the meaning of the word in a certain context. But we agree on the mechanism, and that's what's important. Yeah, we agree on the meaning, the overall meaning, but just the exact, you know, how this relates to certain words, that's what we disagree a little bit about. And it's kind of irrelevant. And this is I think, one of the important things in Buddhism is that we are allowed to disagree about things. Of course, if you live in Bodhinyana Monastery, you have to agree with certain things. If you think jhana is rubbish, you cannot live in Bodhinyana Monastery. If you think that rebirth is it's nothing to do with rebirth, also very hard to live in Bodhinyana Monastery. So you have to have a certain broad outlook in common. If you have that broad outlook in common, then whether you disagree about certain minor things, actually it's only good, because it gives rise to a bit of discussion, and then often you learn from that discussion. So don't be afraid of disagreement. Disagreement is always, I think, a positive thing that makes us all grow.
Yeah, we also, I think, in the office one day, we agreed upon that even arahants, enlightened people, might explain dependent origination in different ways. They might see it slightly differently. So, for example, some people say Ajahn Chah, he taught dependent origination. He taught sometimes moment-to-moment kind of thing, or more in this life. Does that mean he's not an arahant then, because it's something different than the Buddha said? Well, first of all, I don't really know what Ajahn Chah taught. Those translations may be accurate or not. But the point I'm trying to make is you can be enlightened and still have a different understanding from somebody else who may also be enlightened. But those difference of understandings only exist on like a more technical, more superficial level. The deeper understanding is the same. So, not saying we're enlightened, but when we agree disagree, it's only on this superficial, not so important level. Yeah,
it's very nice to disagree with Sunil, because he's a pretty cool character. Yeah, so you can disagree with him in a civilized way, which is really nice, actually. Yeah. Anyway, let's under the okay, let's move on. Let's find out what is the cause of. Please, yeah, Ananda, yeah. Let's get the microphone on Ananda before we, so we can see what happens there.
Uh, You mentioned two ways of looking at this, that is on Kamma Bhava and Upapatti Bhava.
Yeah.
But I think Kamma Bhava, now it's after to the boxing duel.
Sorry?
After listening to the boxing match, not watching, listening. And I'm just wondering whether it is for we people, Kamma Bhava is something that we can see and experience and that we can see right here and now.
Yeah.
Upapatti Bhava is something that is in the unknown.
Yeah.
I'm saying we know as a theoretical way, in an intellectual way we know.
Yeah.
And I think Buddha has said Dhamme Jnana and Anve Jnana. By applying those two, the true knowledge and the inferential knowledge, we can imagine or we can have some understanding. But Kamma Bhava is urges us, it spurs us, it sort of lifts us to do the right thing.
Yeah.
So I think my way of thinking, I like to see that it is a Kammapatha, Kamma Bhava, that it is the one, it is the fruition of the actions, that it is the results of our actions or the Kamma. The karma ripening, if you like, karma ripening is the bhava.
Yeah.
Would that be a right way of looking at it?
To my mind, it sounds right. We will talk about this in much more detail later on. But the idea that you can actually experience the ripening of karma right now, I think, is right there in the suttas. It's the kind of the karma which ripens in this life. And that is just the feeling, you know, when you do an act, how do you feel about yourself? And we all know that our intention when we do something actually matters enormously for how you feel about yourself. You do an act of kindness, you actually feel good about yourself. Yeah, when I say a kind word to somebody, when I hold back my fighting instinct with a venerable sinner, I hold it back and I think, oh, actually sinner is a really nice guy, so I should really have kindness and compassion towards him. Straight away you feel much better than if you kind of go into an unskillful way. So you can see the relationship between intention and how you feel about yourself right here and now. And that is, so you can see both, and that is almost like seeing both the Kamma Bhava and the Upapatti Bhava almost in this life, although it is, you're right, the Upapatti is also more about the future life, so it's a bit more difficult. Anyway, let's continue. So now we are looking at the next link, Upadana Paccaya Bhavo, and upadana is this a very important Pali word, which quite literally means something like taking up. Yeah, so we take up things, and when we use the word taking up, we mean this both in the literal sense. Yeah, you are thirsty, so you take up the glass of water. Yeah, you pick it up, and then you drink. Okay, I'm not going to do that now because I'm not thirsty, but I'm just showing you. Yeah, so we actually pick things up in the world. We take things up. You go to a lunch table, and I think if you next Saturday, if you want to come over to the main hall and have some lunch, I think you're very welcome to do so. If you haven't brought your own, don't have to feel shy. Ajahn Brahm asked me, where are all the attendants from your course? Why aren't they coming? Don't they like the food over here? Because there's so much food over there, and I think that some of the people who bring food, they will be delighted to share that. Yeah? So please don't feel shy about coming over there and sharing in that. So you're hungry, so you pick things up. Yeah, but it's not just picking up of immediate things. It's also a metaphorical picking up. It's a picking up of ideas, picking up of views, picking up of relationships, picking up of an education, picking up of a large amount of things. Everything in the world that we pick up and we make it part of our life, that is part of this upadana. In the technical sense, you could argue, this is another small discussion I had with Venerable Sunyo, that upadana just refers to the literal meaning of picking up. But of course, once you pick things up, you tend to hold on. Yeah, once you get into a relationship, what happens? You hold on to that relationship. You're not happy if your partner leaves you or that does something bad or whatever. You're not happy with that. So picking up always is a starting point of attachment, of holding on. You pick up a view. Yeah, I'm a Buddhist. Yeah, and as soon as you've picked up that view, you attach a little bit to it. And if someone says, oh, Buddhists are really stupid, they're just a bunch of superstitious fools, you think, no way, Buddhists are really good. And so you start defending yourself. You know what it's like, yeah? Or with political views. And it's a vast range of things that we pick up. Once we pick certain things up, once we pick up a certain type of life, living in a house rather than living in a monastery, certain views, certain hobbies, a certain religion, our life takes a certain shape. And that is how then upadana, the picking up of things, leads to existence. Because you exist in a way that accords with all the things that you pick up in your life. Yeah? And then you attach to that, your mind inclines towards that, and then you get reborn in accordance with that in the future. Does that make sense? Yeah? Anybody?
I'd like to point out that the word upadana has actually multiple meanings, and one of the other meanings is fuel. So I'll go into more detail later, or Ajahn Bamali will go into more detail when we discuss in more detail. But some of you have been coming to Ajahn Brahm's classes, and I think he also has been recently translating upadana as fuel. For example, a fuel for a car, you know. They didn't have cars in the time of the Buddha, of course, but that is the word I mean by fuel.
Ox was the fuel.
Yeah. The grass for the ox was the fuel. But with the idea of behind that being, there is something that fuels the continued existence. And that fuel for existence is the craving. That is the previous factor before upadana. Yeah, it also means taking up. So this is one of those cases where you can't translate into English properly one word because it has multiple meanings. But I will leave it at that for now. Yeah.
Okay. So let's go on to the next one. So that is taking up. What is it that makes us take things up? And the thing that makes us take things up is craving or desire or etc. Different translations of that word. Tanha, paccaya, upadana. Tanha is the Pali word for craving or desire. So because we crave things, we pick things up, both literally and also metaphorically. Yeah, we pick up ideas, we pick up views. We need a sense of identity, and that identity craves that we have certain views about the world. We have certain views about whether we're going to exist after death or not. Yeah, all of these things come from that particular craving to exist. Or just the ordinary sensory craving, the craving for sensory objects, means that we pick up things in the world. We pick up certain, you know, living in a house, because a house affords you that sense of place where you can have nice meals together with your family, or you can enjoy some entertainment together, all of these kind of things. It allows you to fulfill those cravings. So craving leads us to all of these picking ups, yeah? And so depending on what that is, and that leads to then the different lifestyles down the track here. Yeah, please.
Craving a third of the four satipatthanas is within that category. Is it a perception that follows
is craving the one of the aspects of the third satipatthana category in the satipatthana?
I think craving is a complex thing. It cannot be reduced to one particular aspect of satipatthana, nor to one particular khanda. Craving is a mixture of it's based on feeling. Yeah. And then the will, the volition, is an important part of craving, because the craving is what drives you. Yeah. So there's a will involved in that. There's a perception involved with it. There's a mm-hmm. feeling involved with it. So I think it's a particular way that the five aggregates come together in a particular way. And that particular way of coming together is called craving. Yeah?
Okay. It's a package deal.
Yeah. You can't reduce it to one thing like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. So feeling leads to craving. So, and this is very obvious. I think we can all understand that. Yeah, we feel the world. And the Buddhist idea of feeling is that feeling is divided into three categories. Feeling here does not mean emotion. And this is one of the reasons why we translated Vedana as sensation rather than feeling. Because feeling in English normally refers to emotions, yeah? Sad, or how you're feeling today, oh, feeling a bit miserable, or feeling really happy, or whatever. But feeling here doesn't really mean that kind of feeling. It just means the tone of experience. Is it a good experience, a bad experience, or a neutral experience? And then good experiences are craved for, bad experiences you are repelled by, and neutral experiences are kind of irrelevant until you become really developed, and then you really want the neutral experiences. Yeah, we don't really understand neutral experiences properly. We are ignorant about them, to use this word again, or deluded about them. But down the path, they become actually the most important parts. So feeling is this very important thing in Buddhism, a very important thing in life. Yeah, our entire lives revolve around feelings. This is what gives life meaning here. Yeah, this is the very kind of one of the cruxes of what existence is about. And this is why it stands out, independent origination, in this way. If there was no feeling, would anything in your life have meaning? If you went out and you saw the sunset, yeah, you think, wow, it's so beautiful, good feeling. But if you look at the sunset, you think, yeah, whatever, yeah. It would be meaningless, right? It would have no meaning anymore because it doesn't give rise to a feeling. So everything in life is based on the feeling that actually that comes with that experience. Only then does it have meaning. If you didn't have any feelings at all, everything in existence would be meaningless. There would be no meaning to anything. You might as well lie down on the bed and stare in the ceiling. That would be equivalent to having the most delicious meal or the most wonderful relationships or having a jhana experience or whatever. It would all be the same. Yeah. So you would lie down on the bed because less effort. Yeah. So that is then how things work. So feeling is really fundamental. And this is why very often when you read the suttas, you find that through understanding feeling, it's the one thing that you need to understand. It is sufficient to reach awakening by understanding feelings properly. Because it is so fundamental. Everything else has meaning because of that. So all the other aggregates also get given meaning because of feeling here.
But basically, the
basic idea is that you cannot control all your feelings. Yeah, that's the basic idea. I mean, sometimes you might think, okay, I'm going to the table. I can choose between ice cream and what's something you hate? What's something you don't like, Chris? Something you really don't like? Yeah. Sweets, okay, you can choose between sweets and ice cream. So which one are you going to take, yeah? So you have some effect on your feelings. But in the long run, you can't control them. And that's why we have negative experiences. If we could control them, we would never have negative experiences. So in the big picture, you're right. So then the answer is, well, how do we deal with the feelings? That is the critical thing, just as you say, yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay. And Monsignor?
No? Okay.
Okay. So now the next one. Contact gives rise to feeling. Contact, passa, paccaya, vedana. Passa is this Pali word which means like to touch, yeah, to contact something. Yeah. And when Basunyo's translation was sense impression, yeah, it is when the senses contact the world. Yeah, every time you have a sense experience, that's called contact. You see somebody, you see Thomas, yeah, you see everyone here. You see the ceiling, whatever it is. It's a sense impression. You hear something. It's a sense impression. Yeah, it's the meeting of the mind with the world, if you like. Yeah? That is contact. In Buddhism, it is often said to be the eye, the object, the ear, the sound, yeah, and that gives rise to consciousness, and the three together is called contact. You experience the world. And then every time you experience the world, there is a feeling that goes with that experience. Neutral, negative, positive, whatever. It's fairly obvious, yeah? You can see why that happens. This is an important point because contact itself, and we shall see this later on, is not just an automatic thing. Contact consists of two aspects. One is like what we call the impingement contact. Impingement means when there is an impact on the sense organ, yeah? The impact of a sight or of seeing something. When you see something, there's like the object hitting the eye, if you like. And then there is what is called the, the naming contact or designation contact. And that is the sense that the mind makes of that contact experience. One is the raw physical reality of contact. One is the interpretation that the mind has of that contact. And that is very important because it means that our mental attitude is so important in how we experience the world. Yeah, we're all sitting here together today. I don't know how many we are. We tried to count before, but we were unable to count. Maybe 100 people or something. And we all experience this situation a little bit differently. Yeah. Some of you say, oh, now I hope it's finished soon. You know, I want to go back home. Some of you think, wow, this is really cool stuff. I never heard this before. Some of you think, oh, yeah, I heard this too many times before already. I don't want to hear it again. Everyone is going to have a slightly different perception, yeah? I'm going to be different. Everyone is going to be different. And the reason for that is because we interpret, we process the information differently depending on our conditioning. So if we recondition ourselves according to the Buddhist teachings, we will experience the world differently. And this is a big part and parcel of what the path is about. We said we were going to make it practical, right? And this is one of those practical aspects in something that may seem very theoretical, but actually there's a very practical aspect right there in the idea of how we contact the world. So now, exciting. What is the core? Oh, 8 minutes left. Quick, yeah. Next slide.
Okay.
Okay, so surprise, surprise. The six sense fields, yeah, or the six senses or are the condition for contact, yeah? Salayatana pachaya paso, which makes sense. You need to have the six senses, and then you need to have the external objects that that react with those senses, and then we have pasta, yeah? That's kind of common sense. I don't need to say too much more about that now. We'll talk much more about this later on. So what is the cause of...
Can I say something?
Please, absolutely.
I know we have to talk quickly now, but I'm not so quick a talker, though. Yeah, in some realm, this seems maybe you mentioned obvious or common sense, but to me, these factors are also some of the deepest in dependent origination. Because usually when we think about experiencing things, it seems like there is a consciousness, the me, and into that consciousness there comes a sight, and into that consciousness there comes a sound. There seems to be a continuity inside of us. But one of the teachings about pasa is that there is no such continuity. The pasa, the contact, what the Buddha is saying there, that there's no one big consciousness into which things arise. Every moment of this contact creates a new moment of consciousness. And that is actually something that is not so very obvious and I think very, very deep actually.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very good point, is the idea that there is no continuity. And is that one of the ways of realizing non-self, I think, is to see that discontinuity in consciousness and how it arises in one sense and another sense, and that there is nothing that goes across from one sense to the next one. So it's actually an important point, yeah. Right. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. There's no kind of beads which don't have any thread which kind of holds them together. It's just exactly. Yeah. I think that's maybe we can bring out that reference at a later time when we do this in more detail. That's an interesting one. Yeah. Okay. So why do we have contact? Why does that happen? And the answer is name and form. So, and again, I was just saying before that contact is divided into two aspects. There is the impingement, the impact on the senses, and then the way that the mind makes sense of that impingement. And this is reflected in name and form. Yeah, form is the physical aspect of existence. That's where the impingement happens, the impact happens. And name is here another word for the mental aspect that makes sense of that contact. So this is one of the reasons, one of the strange reasons, yeah, why the Buddha uses very strange expression, name and form, is to make that division between the physical and the mental, so that we can actually understand the how contact happens in beings. This is one reason. Another reason why the Buddha uses name and form is because this is an expression that was used by the pre-existing Brahmanical religion. I wanted previously to talk a bit more about the relationship between the existing Brahmanism in ancient India. Brahmanism is the precursor to Hinduism, yeah, and how that relates to Buddhist teachings. Because this actually matters enormously if you really want to understand Buddhism. You have to understand what Buddhism was replying to, yeah. What were the existing teachings? And here we have an example of that. The Buddha, it looks like he used name and form because this is a term that was used in Brahmanism, and the Buddha wanted to redefine it, take it into the Buddhist teachings and make it into something that was useful in Buddhism so as to counteract, probably in part, the Brahmanical ideas, give it a new shape, a new idea that was more in accordance with the Buddhist idea of reality rather than the Brahmanical teachings. So this is how we end up with this strange idea and word such as name and form, which otherwise seems kind of weird. Anyway, what is the cause or the condition for name and form? It is consciousness. Yeah, consciousness. Once consciousness here is the idea mainly of rebirth consciousness. Rebirth consciousness is when a consciousness arises in a new existence. Consciousness will have a certain station, vijnana titti, it is called in the suttas. So the consciousness stations itself at a certain level, depending on the inclination it had in a previous life. So let's say that the consciousness stations itself in the human realm. The human realm is like one station of consciousness, yeah? It establishes itself, if you like, in that realm. Or it can establish itself in maybe the animal realm, or it can establish itself in a higher realm, like deva realms. And then, as soon as your consciousness is established in a certain realm, then you are limited by that realm as to what you can experience. If you are reborn as a human being, you will tend to have human experiences. Yeah, that's what it means to be human. If you get reborn as a dog, you will have dog experiences. Oh, dukkha. Yeah, no good. If you get reborn as a deva, you have the deva experiences. Yay, deva, really cool. So you are trapped in a sense for that lifetime. And that is what it means to have a station of consciousness. You are trapped in that lifetime and your name and form, what you can experience is limited by that station of consciousness. So your mental content, your physical form, all of these things are in a sense you have certain boundaries on them, which are determined by the station of consciousness. Please just chime in whenever you like. I'm just going to kind of fire away here.
Excellent.
So, next one here is choices. So this is as we mentioned before, we haven't really been very consistent at all in our translation here. So choices is what we previously translated as willed acts. Yeah, you may think that what is the connection between willed acts and choice, but actually there's a lot of connection here because willing means choosing, so they're basically the same thing here. So here the idea is that when we do willed actions, that is like making kamma, yeah, sankhara is the Pali word, sankhara pachaya vijnana, vijnana is consciousness here, and when we do actions by body, speech and mind, that has an effect on how we feel about ourselves, as I mentioned before. Yeah, so you do things, it affects content. This is kamma. And then that consciousness, depending on how it is established in this life, where it is leaning in this life, that leaning or inclination of consciousness will then decide its station. And you continue from there in your next life. Yeah, so we create the kamma in this life. That kamma is something we can experience in the here and now. It creates a kind of a level, if you like, on a consciousness, a kind of inclination of a consciousness. And then when you die, that level, that inclination carries on into your future existence. Sankhara, pachaya, vijnana. And I have good news. You've come to the very first link. Yeah, we come at the very end, and we have negative 40 seconds in talking about this last link because we are over time already. So please hang in there for a few more seconds. We'll get this one at least talked about briefly. Ignorance, or as some people pointed out on our discussion group, is that ignorance seems like a strange word because people say, I'm not ignorant. Yeah, what do you mean? What do you mean calling me ignorant? I am knowledgeable. I've been to university. I know all this kind of stuff. Yeah, please don't call me ignorant. Okay, so let's alternative translations. The Pali word is avijja. Alternative translation is delusion. Yeah, we see, we don't see reality straight. Another interesting translation or possible rendering is illusion. We see something there which doesn't actually exist. And it brings us back to the basic Buddhist idea that we all see a self in these five khandhas, which actually isn't there. Yeah, so we actually is a real illusion going on. Unknowing was a translation suggested by Venerable Sunyo, quite similar to ignorance. And all of these things are true in different ways. Yeah, it is, in a sense, a degree of ignorance because there are things about the world we don't know. And we can all probably agree on that. There is a degree of distortion in our mental outlook where we see things in the wrong way. We see things that aren't really there. So all of these things really come together. And when we have this distortion in outlook, some of the most important aspects of that distortion is that we think that we can create happiness in our life by living in a certain way. And because we think we can create happiness, we go out and we start to create that happiness. Yeah, and that creative activity, that is the willed actions. I've got willed actions now and I had choices previously. This is really inconsistent. So we go out and we try to create that happiness, yeah, through our willed actions because we think we know where happiness is to be found. So that delusion, that ignorance makes us act in the world, yeah. If we didn't have that illusion, we would not be acting because we know that happiness is not actually to be found through acting at all. Happiness is to be found by sitting down and letting go of all acting and ending this whole process. That is an overview for you. And I'm not going to take it any further than that. We're going to go through each of these aspects in far, far more detail. Some of these aspects we're going to spend at least probably 1 hour talking about each individual link, at least some of the links, because they are very broad and the implications are very large for what is going on here. But I would like to give everyone a chance. If anyone has to leave, please feel free to leave at any time. But I would like you to give people a chance to ask any final questions or comments. Thomas, let's get the microphone first. Thomas at the front here. Thomas at the front, yeah.
I'm just very sad that we missed the few slides on Brahmanism versus Buddhism because you said it was so enormously important. Is that something that we have time to cover later or something that...
Yeah, I think we should try to squeeze it in. At least some of the... Yeah, we should try to squeeze that in. I think it's quite interesting myself and I would like to talk about it as well. Yeah, we shall do that. Let's get the microphone, Ananda. Yeah.
You said, willed action and choices. Yeah. I think... You are trying to show us that everything is transient and nothing is permanent. Thank you.
I wasn't trying to show anything. I was just not mindful enough to know what I was doing. That's the reality of it. Sometimes you just have to be honest, yeah?
No, you're trying to teach some really deep dharma.
Bhante, is the idea of moving through the world without ignorance... suggesting that you can actually move through the world with a personality which is constantly changing. It's a dynamic experience, but not a sense of self. Is that what liberation is? That we don't take a sense of self as we work through the world. We still stop at red lights and go at green lights and get the right change at shops, but we do that knowing that we are a process as opposed to a solid sort of thing. Is that what that first ignorance is really talking about?
Yeah, that's part of it, I would say. It's part of it that when you, you know, a lot of the way that people live their lives is a very driven kind of thing.
Yes.
The sense of self drives you.
Yes.
So you come to the green light, you come to the red light, think, come on, go green. Yeah. I need to go. And then maybe you honk your horn or whatever you do. I don't know what people do. But when you get rid or you kind of eliminate the ignorance at the beginning, you actually... you come to the red light and you are at peace with it. You can deal with it. Yeah, there's not that drivenness anymore. The ego or the sense of self doesn't drive you towards anything. And you just go with the flow of things. That is the big difference. But there's difference also in a much deeper way. And that is the sense that you don't actually seek any happiness in that world. And it's precisely because you don't seek any happiness in that world that you're not driven. As long as you're seeking happiness in that world, that is what drives you. But when you understand that happiness is actually found in not in that world at all, but actually not doing anything, sitting on your bottom, crossing your legs, watching your breath, and then being at peace, that is where you find real happiness. It's in the opposite of action. It is in non-action that real happiness is to be found. It makes the whole, you turn everything upside down. Yeah, and this is also a very important part of that. You look for happiness in a very, very different way.
Yeah, well, you've still got to do the shopping, though, John.
Yeah.
So, taking your analogy, bringing that feeling of sitting on the cushion, dwelling in equanimity and peace.
Yeah.
But we have to actually act in the world as well to feed ourselves and all of that sort of stuff. So there is a sense of us needing to assume a personality as we move through the world, and as I said, get the right change at shops and stop at red lights and go at green lights. So is that what an arahat is? It's someone who actually has mastered that capacity to move through the world without a sense of self-absorption, self-focus, as you were just describing, which you're eminently describing in meditation, but are we talking here about someone who can then take that feeling space, etc., those batch of perceptions out into the world and stay wide and broad?
Well, wide and raw. I mean, you wouldn't go shopping if you're an arahant. You'd be wearing different clothes. You'd be having different hairstyle. Yeah, you would be looking quite different. So sometimes you get these ideas that an arahant is just like any other person, except that they're slightly different inside. But you still go to work and all these kind of things. But you don't. The moment you become an arahant, that whole world is meaningless to you, and you will go to the nearest monastery and say, please, give me kuti, I want to ordain.
Yeah, but it's not a light switch. It's not an off on, I'm a householder or a monk.
It isn't.
It's a gradual dimmer switch from one to the other.
Yeah, it is a gradual thing. So you're right. You're quite right. But it is gradual. And what you learn is that you just learn, as you say, you become less... a willful person. You are less driven person. Mm-hmm. You are less sense of self in it. You tend to go more with the flow of things. Just look at someone like Ajahn Brahm. He's very good at going with the flow. He will just sit there and he will kind of, sometimes he, and this is, there's something beautiful about that. There's much less resistance in the world. And a lot of the problem, a lot of the suffering comes from not being able to go with the flow, but always reacting to the world. That is a big part of the problem.
Okay, thank you, Bhante. The second question is, name and form, is daydreaming, is that nama or rupa?
Daydreaming?
Daydreaming is nama or rupa?
It's nama, yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. That's an unusual question, never heard that one before.
Were you daydreaming during the class? If anyone wants a copy of the book based on Ajahn Brahmali's Friday night talk given here on dependent origination, please see Cherish. She will be in the hall. There are about 45 copies we have, and the rest of the copies we will print next time. Thank you.
Okay. Everyone happy? Yeah, okay. Very nice to have you all here today. And
sadhu for coming.
Let's just pay homage to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha together before we go. It's a nice thing to do.
Should also get the slides online somehow. People have asked for it.
Oh, just put the slides online. Yeah, that's a good idea.
It's really going to be a game changer for a lot of people. You don't know, but you've got a lot of groups all over the world.
Okay.
Super safe.
Yeah.
And they really value this sort of thing. So that's why I asked the question.
But yeah, exactly. And I think it's nice to do this kind of thing. Do something slightly different.